Our dog Toby. He's a Brittany Spaniel and a part of our home. If you've been to my house, you've probably met Toby. He loves people, and so sometimes he loves people more than I want him to love people. And so if you've been at my house with a group of people, you've probably heard him in the back room wanting to be out with the people, or either you've seen him go by really fast, being shuffled into the back room. But we love our dog. We're dog fans. But what if we were to pretend that your dog and every dog in the world was in deep distress? If it would help all the dogs in the world, would you, as a human, be willing to become a dog? Would you lay aside your human nature, leave your family, friends, job, vacations, favorite TV shows, eating good meals, choosing what you want to eat most of the time? Would you leave all of that and become a dog? Would you choose to live like a dog, which basically means that all you think about is eating, right? Or wagging your tail, or seeing what your master, your owner, has to say, or what he's going to do or she's going to do? Would you exchange all of what it means to be a human and become a dog if it meant that you could potentially rescue all the other dogs out there that were in distress? Probably not many of us would sign the dotted line for that agreement, would we? We wouldn't want to lay aside, as much as we love Toby, I would never lay aside who I am as a human. My relationship with my wife, my kids, being a human to think rationally, make decisions, make money, enjoy vacations, eat, all the things that go with being a human. I would never lay all of that aside to become a dog. Even if Toby was in deep distress, I would never lay it aside to become a dog. We're in a series within a series called Prologue. Our bigger series is called The Belief Project. It's a journey through the Gospel of John that we've said is going to take us a long time. And so we're breaking it up into little mini-series along the way and throw in some other series here and there. But we're in a four-week part of it right now called The Prologue. And it starts in John chapter 1. If you have a Bible, turn to John chapter 1. We teach and preach the Bible here at City Church, so I always encourage you to bring your Bible. Pull it up on your smartphone. We'll even throw the verses up for you on the screen. But we're in John chapter 1. And what we said last week is this first section of John's gospel is one of the most profound truths in all of Scripture. And the truth is that the Word that we discovered last Sunday, who is equal with God, as John introduces us to the Word, he's equal with God, he's eternally God, and yet he became flesh. He laid aside his divine rights to put on human skin, to become one of us. And John introduces us to this person that he calls the Word that we learn is Jesus. And the first three verses of John's gospel gives us some extremely lofty truths about the Word. John says, in the beginning, like existing before anything and everything. This is like Genesis 1 stuff. Last week we said. In Genesis 1 where it says, in the beginning, God created. This is Genesis 1 stuff. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was there in the beginning. Before time, before history, before a single thing had been created, there was the Word. In the beginning, when there was God plus nothing, the Word was there. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. So the Word obviously is of eternal divine significance. And John says the Word was with God. He is equally God. He's equally God, and yet he's separate from the Father. And we said last week that we've kind of put that into human terms that we call the Trinity, and trying to wrap our minds around the Trinity is difficult. But what John says is the Word was eternally God. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He continues in verse 1. The Word was God. He was equal with God. So whatever it is that makes God God, the Word possesses that. Whatever it is, the DNA that makes up who God is, the Word possesses those same things. Verse 2, He was in the beginning with God. So there it is again. He was in the beginning with God. Verse 3, all things were made through Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. So this Word that John introduces us to was in the beginning with God, was God, and then he takes it a step further and says, all things were made by Him with a spoken word. In other words, the Word speaks and stuff happens. We said last week, the Word says mountain and the majestic mountains bolt into the sky. The Word says animals and animals appear. The Word says galaxies and stars are flung throughout eternity. The Word says sun and this blazing fireball appears in the sky to light the darkened sky. The Word speak and stuff simply happens. Humans happens. Galaxies happen. Mountains happen. Animals happen. The Word speaks and things take place. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. He is the creator of all things. And then we said what's amazing about this truth is that this Word is the creator of all things, who speaks and stuff happens, who thinks things into reality. This Word, John says in verse 14, this Word, the Word, became flesh and He dwelt among us. The Word became flesh. I want to remind you this morning that one of the truths we learn from John's gospel is that the trajectory of God's words is always bent towards reality. In other words, when God speaks, things happen. God is not all talk. When God says stuff, it becomes a reality. Now, this is like fairy tale world, right? When we think about it. We think about the power to speak, and whatever words you speak become a reality. Those are fairy tales. They're fables that we grew up hearing of King Midas and other people. When he touched something, it would turn to gold, or the power of Pixar. If someone speaks something, then it becomes a reality. Those are fairy tale legends to us, or stories in a children's book. But God's trajectory is when He speaks, things happen. Stuff happens. God is never all talk. He speaks and it happens. His words become a reality. The word that we use for that is incarnation, which is the Latin word that means to become flesh, that God became one of us, that the Word became flesh. God becomes human flesh. He did not just talk. He actually became one of us. There's a very common complaint against followers of Jesus that basically goes like this. You Christians, your actions do not match your words. Our proclamation, what we say, what we speak, lacks incarnation. It lacks reality. Sometimes we're all talk. Words come across as insincere, hypocritical, and inconsistent at times because of our actions. We talk a lot about grace, but do we live a life of grace? We talk a lot about forgiveness and that we've been forgiven, and yet we are known for holding grudges just like the person beside us that doesn't profess Jesus. We talk about forgiveness, but we live lives that are marked by bitterness at times toward an ex-spouse, toward someone who's hurt us. We talk about love and grace and acceptance, and yet many times we do not exhibit the things that we talk about. And people point the accusing finger and say, well, it's easy to talk about those things, it's hard to live them. And yet the bent of God is His words become a reality. Incarnation is His heartbeat. He becomes flesh. As a matter of fact, I showed you John's purpose statement of his gospel that we'll go back to time and time again throughout the Belief Project. In John chapter 20, John gives us the reason why he writes his book. And look at how he says this. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. John says, I've written this gospel to show you the things that Jesus did, the signs that he did that pointed to who he was. John grounds belief, the call to belief, in what Jesus did. That he was God in the flesh. The claims of Jesus were backed up by his life. A visible demonstration, not just proclaiming one message and living another. The claims of Jesus were backed up in how he lived life. If we were to flip through the early chapters of Acts, we would discover that most of the known world of that day identified the church not by their doctrines and their beliefs, but their behavior. How they loved each other, how they treated other people. Their claims of following a resurrected Jesus were backed up by the way they lived life. And when John is telling the story of Jesus in his gospel, his theology is very lofty, we see out of the gate. Word was God, equally God, eternally God. I mean, creator of the world, sustains all things. That's some lofty language, some high theological language, but it's also very fleshy because he's telling a bigger story. He's telling a redemptive story of a God who pursues sinful humans. And John does not leave God aloof and removed in the heavens from his creation. He emphasizes God's entrance into our space. The Word became flesh. The eternal God has moved into our neighborhood. He got his hands dirty. He lived among his people. He built things as a carpenter. He was hurt. He was wounded. He moved into our broken space, into our broken world. John continues this thought in our message today. Look in verse 4. In him, again referring to the Word, referring to Jesus, in him was life. And the life was the light of men. John says, in the Word, in Jesus, is life. Now, life is one of John's favorite words. He uses it 36 times just in his gospel. It's a very common word for John, but when we see the word life, we know that that immediately implies that there is death, that the life entered into a world that was marked by death. Now, during our escape series, we saw that Jesus was not controlled by death in any way. As a matter of fact, Jesus controlled death. Death was on his timetable. He was not on death's timetable. And Jesus often conquered death while he was on earth. He raised people back to life. And then the ultimate display of life was when Jesus died for our sins and then was raised back to life eternally. The resurrection proves that he was in control of life, that Jesus is life. Now, we live in a culture of death. If you watched the news when you got up this morning, you saw the story of a man who walked into a bar, a club last night, and killed dozens and dozens of people, that took the lives of other people. The night before, in the very same city in Orlando, a guy drove and came face to face in a meet and greet with someone that I think was on The Voice and shot and killed her point blank. We live in a culture that's marked by violence and marked by death, and even death itself when it comes in the form of sickness or old age or accidents, that we live in a culture that is marked by death. And death's effects are not just that a person stops breathing, that their life ends. Death's effects, its chilly grip, reaches into all areas of our lives. And we feel the effects of sin, and we feel the effects of death. And death kills stuff, and sin kills stuff, right? And we hide secrets, and we feel the effects of death as we hide things that kill relationships. And we get confused when death enters the picture, and it creates doubts and it creates uncertainty, and we feel the weight of death. And many of you are in relationships that sin has killed stuff in that relationship. It's killed a marriage, or it's killed a relationship with your spouse, or you've made decisions where sin has killed things in your life. It's killed your bank account, or it's killed your peace of mind or peace of heart. We live in a culture, in a world that's marked by death, and yet Jesus says, I am life, that I entered into the world marked by death to bring life. To bring life to those whose lives have been marked by the enormity of sin. You feel grief this morning? He is life. Do you feel loneliness today? He is life. Look at verse 5. John continues. Ali will see life. Verse 5, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. John tells us that the word, that Jesus also is light. That light shines. Where does the light shine? It shines in the darkness. The reason that we know that light exists is because there is darkness, and the darkness gives way to the light. If you've ever been in a situation where it's really dark and you pulled out a very bright flashlight or a bright beam of light, then you know the importance of light, that it opens up things, that you can see things, that it takes darkness and transforms it into something that's not quite as scary and threatening. And John says that the light entered into the darkness. Remember, he takes lofty theological truths and he makes them very fleshy. The light enters into the darkness. The incarnation. He becomes flesh. Light enters darkness. He enters our dark arena. He enters our dark space that is marked by sin and darkness. He enters that. And I love how he wraps up verse 5. The darkness has no power. The darkness cannot overcome the light. Now we know that the darkness tried to overcome the light when Jesus was here, but it failed. That's good news for us. The darkness fell. The darkness can't overcome the light. But some of you today, you're living under the weight of darkness, aren't you? Maybe it's something that you've tucked away in your own heart and life that you live with day in and day out that no one else knows about, but it darkens your soul and heart. When you think about it, when you reflect about it, no matter how you try to bury it, it weighs upon you, the darkness of what you're hiding. The confusion, the doubt, the enormity of sin, the addiction, it weighs on you. It darkens your heart. And the gospel to you today is, know that Jesus is light, that he penetrates the darkness, and the darkness can't overcome it. Can you wrap your mind around that? That whatever it is in your life that you think is an enormous sin, that's an enormous darkness that weighs on your heart, there's nothing that is too big for Jesus. That the light penetrates the darkness, that there is no darkness, no amount of darkness that can overcome the light. The light has come into the world. Look at verse 9. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. So again, John puts this into real life. The true light was coming into the world. The true light came into the world. It penetrated the darkness, and each person is confronted with its truth. John says that it shines on everyone, it enlightens everyone, that all of us, when the light enters our space, the light confronts us. Will we believe or will we not believe? But we are confronted with the light of God. Here's what I love about what John's doing here. What John is saying is the light enters the darkness. Don't miss this, that he came into our dark space, that he empathizes with us. That God did not leave us alone, blinded by the darkness, but he enters into our space and he empathizes with us. That when Jesus was on earth and when he took on human flesh and when he put on human skin, that he feels the pain that we feel. He felt the loneliness. He felt the grief. He felt the betrayal. He felt the disappointment. He felt the things that we feel. He empathized with us. The light came into the world. He came into our space and he empathizes with us in the brokenness. As a matter of fact, look how he ties this to verse 10. The light came into the world, verse 10, he was in the world and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. Now, if we were to leave these verses alone, they're very sad verses because Jesus went through the ultimate betrayal. The Creator came into the world, he created, and it did not recognize him. He made the world, he sustains the world, he enters the world, and yet he's not recognized by the world. You ever see that show on, I think it's on CBS, Undercover Boss? It's usually some CEO of some multi-million dollar company that has multiple locations and many times thousands of employees, and the boss will disguise himself and he'll appear as another employee or someone being trained, or he'll put himself in the context of kind of his blue-collar working employees and to get feedback on how the company's doing. And it's always an entertaining show to watch when they realize that the guy that they either helped or criticized was the boss. He was an undercover boss. He was not recognized. And the Bible says that the God, the Word, created the world. He sustains the world with a spoken word. He enables it to keep going. And yet when he entered the world, when he took on human flesh, he was not recognized. Now, we're not talking about just people didn't recognize him because they were unfamiliar with who he was. Look at verse 11. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. It's one thing to be betrayed. It's another thing to be betrayed by your own people, by your own family. They also rejected him. It was the ultimate betrayal. That even those that were supposed to love him and embrace him, his own people, they also rejected him. Here's why they rejected, and we continue to reject today. Another verse says that we prefer the darkness. That we prefer the chaos. We prefer the brokenness, that our hearts are inclined not toward righteousness, but toward sin. And our hearts are inclined toward the darkness. The implication is that we prefer the darkness. We are just like our original parents. We prefer our own path, and we fail to recognize the true source of light and life. And we seek a lot of paths to bring us life and direction, and we reject the source of that light and life. Verse 12. But not everyone rejected, did they? But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born, not of blood or will of the flesh nor the will of man, but of God. Not everyone rejects the incarnate Word. Not everyone rejects the Savior. God speaks of a remnant who identifies with Jesus, that they believe in his name is the word that John uses. That was very important in the Hebrew culture. When you go back and read in the Old Testament, the very first commandments have to do with the name of God, right? You shall not take the name of the Lord our God in vain. The name of God was extremely important in the Hebrew context. As a matter of fact, when Bible translators were translating the Old Testament, when they would come to the word Jehovah God, Yahweh, they would write the name, and then they would get up and go and take a bath and come back and begin writing again. That's how much they respected the name of God. And John says there's a remnant of people who receive him, who believe in who he is, who believe in his name, that they believe in who God is, that they believe who Jesus claims to be. And these people have received him. This remnant of people have believed in him, identify with him. And the result of that is that this remnant is given the right to become children of God, to join the family. John uses new birth language here, terminology. And look what he says the new birth is not. He says, one, it's not of blood. It's not of blood. In other words, it's not anything you can do to inherit it. It's not by ancestry. It's not based on your family. You're not a follower of Jesus because your grandparents and parents were followers of Jesus. You're not a Christian because you grew up in a Christian home. He says it's not by blood. Now, let's say that's good news for some of you because your family did not point you to Jesus. They pointed you the opposite direction. And so it's good news that it's not based on our ancestry. For some of you, it's an awakening moment that you need to realize you're not a Christian just because dad and mom were. It's not of blood. And then he says it's not of the will of the flesh. John says it's not by determining to live a good life. There's not some self-help determination that's going to enable you to become a child of God. Our attempts at self-righteousness insult God because he is holy. We can't will our way to God. We can't be good enough to earn God's favor. We can't keep a checklist of good things and righteous things that will somehow tip the scale in our favor. John says it's not of the will of the flesh. It's not white-knuckling yourself. I can be good enough this week even though I failed last week. John says it's not of the will of the flesh, nor is it of the will of humans. No person can make you a Christian. Not a pastor, not a priest, not a pope. There's no ceremony that you can perform that makes you a follower of Jesus. There's no ritual that you can go through. There's no creed that you can recite. There's no standing and sitting performance. You ever gone to one of those churches? A lot of standing, sitting, kneeling. You don't figure out it's like a calisthenic workout all at once. It's not none of those rituals that can make you a follower of Jesus. It's not by a person. It's not of humans. It's not getting baptized or receiving communion. It's not, those are not the things that make you a follower of Jesus. So how does it happen? Look what John says. You are born of God. It's not your ancestry. It's not some self-determination or self-righteousness that makes you a child of God. It's not the will of humans. It's not your determination. John says it's those who have been born of God, that God awakens our hearts to the gospel and we embrace who Jesus is, that we believe that he is the light to our darkness, that he is the life to our death. Remember the conversation that Jesus had with Nicodemus a few chapters from now? We'll cover that in time to come, but Jesus has this conversation with this religious leader, Nicodemus, who comes to Jesus at night and says, what does it take to be born again? And they have this spiritual conversation, and Jesus makes it clear to him, Nicodemus, this is a spiritual act of God that we're talking about. It awakens your heart to the good news. And this is good news. That is not based on my family tree. That is not based on what Devin can pull off in terms of rightness and goodness and wholesome living, because I can tell you I'm going to fail. That is not based on some ritual that I fail to perform. It's not based on some confessional booth that I show up in or do not show up in. This is good news for sinners. That it is of God from beginning to end. That no amount, listen, here's the gospel, that no amount of human sin can keep you from God. And no amount of human effort can earn God's favor. That's great news for us. There's nothing we can do that keeps us from the love of God. And there's nothing that we can do to earn God's love. That he loves us. That he entered our world right where you're at. That he has done everything necessary. The Word became flesh. John's purpose, believe in who he is. Believe that he is the Son of God. Believe in who he is. God's trajectory is always real life. It's always fleshy. It's always incarnation oriented. The Word became flesh. Jesus displayed God on earth. He moved into our territory. I like to say it this way. Jesus is the ultimate display, the ultimate icon of God, the ultimate representation, the ultimate image of God. If you want to know what God looks like, read the life of Jesus. Jesus represents who God is. He's the representation of God. Devin, what does God look like? Study the life of Jesus. You'll learn what it looks like for God to live on earth among us. When Kaylee was younger, she was infatuated with Justin Bieber, not the new Justin Bieber with his adult attempts at pop music, but the old, like, tweener Justin Bieber, like long hair and can't see out of his eyes because of his hair and pants down to his knees, that kind of Justin Bieber. Remember that Justin Bieber, like the old Justin Bieber, not the new one? And so Kaylee was infatuated when she was probably 12, 13 years old with Justin Bieber. And so for Christmas one year, we got her a life-size replica of Justin Bieber. Wait, it's Justin Bieber. We got her a life-size, see what I did there, replica of Justin Bieber and put it in her closet on Christmas and had her go open the door. Yeah, it's Justin Bieber. Was it Justin Bieber? No, she was a Bieberite, Bee-believer, whatever they call those moms and their daughters who are infatuated with Justin Bieber. Was it him? No, but it was a representation of him. When Jesus was on the earth, he was a representation of God. God in the flesh, God incarnate. When the light invades our darkened hearts, when the light penetrates our darkness, when our spiritual souls are awakened by God, here's the next step in that. Not only is Jesus the icon of God the Father, when the light penetrates our hearts, when our deadened souls are made alive by the gospel, we become the icon of Jesus. We become the representatives of who he is. The church is the representatives of Jesus. Now, John gives us a real life example. Again, he always goes from deep theology into incarnation, into flesh. Look what he says in 6. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He puts it into history. He provides us a real life example. There was a man, unlike the Word, who's eternally and equally God. There's a created man. He was one of us. And so what he's doing is he's putting all of us in the same category. Right after God the Father, eternally God, equally God, became flesh, was with God, light penetrated darkness, life breathed into death, there was a man. There was one of us whose name was John. He was sent by God. His purpose was God-given. He was on task. What was his task? Verse 7, he came as a witness to bear witness about the light that all might believe through the light, through him. This real life, tangible example that we know as John the Baptizer, he had one purpose. His purpose was to bear witness to the true light, to point people to the light. Now, this is important to notice in verse 7. He was not the light, right? Now, verse 8. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. This is important. He was not the light. There's only one light. And it's not you and it's not me. He was not the light. He was a witness of the light. It is so important as we are living as Jesus followers, it is so important to know who we are not. We're not the light. We simply point people to Jesus. We are flawed. We are sinful. We are imperfect. We are not the final jury. We are not better than everyone else. We are not the light. And that perspective provides me the opportunity to be authentic, right? When you're having that conversation about who Jesus is, what he's done in your life, it allows me to be authentic, to say, I haven't always gotten it right. Look, here's my story. It's one of brokenness. It's one of redemption and healing because I was broken. It allows us the opportunity to be authentic and allows us the opportunity to be humble. For some reason, what I've discovered in my Christian journey is like it seems like sometimes the longer you're on the journey, the less humble we become. Because we feel like we've got it figured out and I'm better than them and I don't do that and look what he does and I don't do and look who they support and I don't support. And it's very easy for us to become prideful and boastful, but when we realize we are not the light, it allows us the freedom to be authentic and to be humble. That we are one beggar telling other beggars where to find the food, pointing people to the light. The more I follow the great I am, the more I realize what I am not. That it's by his grace and redemption that should keep us humble and authentic in who we are. Now, he uses a key word here, the word witness. What are the traits of a witness? If you're called to a court of law as a witness to a crime or some accident, Think about what a witness is. It's someone that has seen or experienced something firsthand. This person saw the wreck take place. This person saw the crime be committed. You've experienced something firsthand. A witness also has to be willing to testify. If you see a crime or an accident take place, but you refuse to talk about what you've seen or heard, then it's irrelevant what you saw. And then a witness has to be committed to the truth of what they saw. You can't get on the witness stand and change your mind. Well, I saw this. Oh, wait. No, I saw this, and it's the exact opposite. A witness is someone who has seen and experienced and is willing to share, and they're committed to that truth. They're not neutral to it. And John says those who have received life and light are witnesses of the light, that we are the representatives of Jesus, pointing people to the true light. Let me take some relief off of you. You can't save people. I can't save people. We can't save people. You can't heal hearts. You can't heal marriages. You can't heal brokenness. We can't do those things. We are not the light. But you know what we can do? We can point people to the light. We can point people to the one who saves darkened souls. We can point people to the one who heals marriages. We can point people to the one who heals sinful hearts. We can point people to the one who redeems and restores and heals. We can point people to the light. We can serve as witnesses. And really, that's all God asks of us, is to be a witness. You can't even save yourself, much less someone else. You can't even heal your own heart. But we can point people to the one that can. We can point our own hearts to the one who can. We can rest in who He is. God breathes life into spiritually dead souls. God speaks light into our darkness. And we are born of God, not from family or human effort or rituals. And our purpose, listen, our purpose changes. We become witnesses of the light. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. And he had a purpose. He was not the light. He was sent to bear witness to the light. There is a man named Devin who is not the light, but is sent to bear witness to the light, because my heart has been awakened to the gospel. There is you. You are not the light. But if your heart has been made alive in Jesus, you have been sent to bear witness to the light. In the New Testament, Jesus is called the radiance of God's glory. We are a reflection of that radiance. In the New Testament, Jesus is called the exact representation of God. The exact representation of God. Look at Jesus, see God. Exact representation of God. We are not the exact representation of God or Jesus, but we should be a reasonable reflection, representation of Jesus. We are not the source of anything divine, but we should be a faithful witness and an accurate reflection of who Jesus is. Who is Jesus? Here's where we're going to pick up in the next 2 weeks. The Word became flesh and lived among us, and what we'll learn about the Word is He was full of grace and truth. What is God like? Jesus. What is Jesus like? the church. That's a scary thought. It's a calling that we embrace with humility, authenticity, and honor. And we'll start to see next week what that looks like. Full of grace and full of truth. Let me leave you with this thought. If you're a follower of Jesus, you're a witness to the light. What does that look like? What does that mean? Let's flesh it out quick, just briefly. If you're a spouse, you're a witness to the light, to your spouse. That I point my spouse to Jesus. The words that I choose to use, how I interact with them, how I love them, how I respond to them when I'm angry, how we argue, how we disagree, how when my opinion is different than hers. As a husband, as a wife, you are called to be a witness of the light. How I interact with Ashley should be reflected by the reality, I'm a witness to the light. If you're a parent, you are a witness to the light. In your most intimate of relationships, with a spouse, with kids, how I interact with my children, how I discipline them, how I love them, how I laugh with them, how when I get angry at them, how when we have disagreements, all those moments, we are to be a witness to the light. To point them to Jesus. That when I fail them, that I'm the first to ask for their forgiveness, to tell them when I was wrong. That when they sin or when they turn away from God or when they make wrong decisions, that I'm the one to display Jesus to them in how I love them, how I forgive them, how I correct them, how I enable them to make wise decisions, God-honoring decisions. As the parent, I am a witness to the light to the ones I love the most. And you can play this out at every level. As a coworker, as a boss, as a friend, as a neighbor, you are a witness to the light. You're not the light. That's how I know I'm going to fail Ashley at times and I'm going to sin against her. I'm not the light. That's how I know I'm a broken parent and there's going to be times I make the wrong decision and sin against my kids. I'm not the light. That means at times I'm not going to be a good neighbor. I'm not the light. That means at times I'm going to get angry. I'm going to get frustrated. I'm going to sin against the people in my sphere of influence, in my social circle. I'm not the light. That means at times I'm going to let you down as your pastor. I want to fail you as a friend. I'm not the light, but I am a witness to the light. And so in those moments, we point people to Jesus. We turn our own hearts to Jesus. We rest in who Jesus is, that He is the light that has penetrated our dark hearts. How are you doing today? Is your life pointing people to Jesus? Are you a witness of the light? If your heart has been awakened by the gospel, you, like me, like John, have been sent by God as a witness to bear witness about the light. And I love that last phrase in that verse, that all might believe through Him. We serve and worship a Jesus who can transform lives. Yours, mine, and all those around us. Let's point people to the light. He is the life. He is the light. Rest in who He is. And next week, we'll see what that means. And man, a life that is full of grace and full of truth.